This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasurthy. It's a Friday. Dr. George Lee, consultant neurologist in the studio with us. How are you today, George?
I'm very good. Well, excited that we're coming to the end of the...
You sound nervous.
I'm always nervous in front of you, Meera.
Not me. It's got nothing to do with me today.
Well, now I'm extra nervous because I've got an ex-boss, really, technically.
Right? What? Yeah, well, technically. She really behaves.
Yeah, that's right. Ex-boss from University of Malaya. That's
I can
right.
sit back and relax today because she will take care of you today.
Wow, and you haven't for all these years?
Yeah, so she can help me today.
All right.
That's right.
Welcome to the show, Prof. Dr. Adiba Kamaruzzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, and Chairman of the Malaysian AIDS Foundation. And we have you here today because the 1st of December was World AIDS Day, and we felt that, you know what, we needed to go through some kind of a report card to see where we are in terms of the management of HIV and AIDS in Malaysia and what's really happening around the world. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
Very well, Meera.
Yeah, and it's so difficult to get you here because you're so busy, you know, an international figure who's championing all the, you know, sucking up with ex-boss. Probably won my old job back.
Well, I will add on to that. Honorary doctorate by the Deputy Chancellor of Monash University. That was about, 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And you got that because of your contribution to research and on infectious diseases and as a health advocate. And you were the first woman to be appointed as the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine in UM in 2011. It's been, 6 years now? Mm-hmm. Wow.
But who's counting?
We are. I mean, we're very proud of all of this,
Thank
you know.
You.
And to have had you here, I mean, what does it feel like? I mean, it's been, 6 years as the Dean? How's that coming along?
Of course, it's got its ups and downs. But I think, you know, we've managed to put in a few new things, like a new curriculum for the medical program that will see the first graduates next year. Mm-hmm. And I think, it was a bit of a struggle because we were implementing it in a hurry, and there was initially some resistance. But, you know, hopefully we will see
Positive outcomes.
Yes, positive outcomes. We not only changed the curriculum, but we also made changes to student selection. So we put in an entrance exam that we worked with UK's Cambridge Assessment. I don't know if you set the BMAT, George, when you...
No, that's way before that. I'm way before that.
Okay. So I mean, it's the same exam that's used by... there are two entrance exams in the UK. So this is one that's used by half of the medical schools there, including some of the top schools. So, yeah, it's been adapted for
Why
us.
Did you think there was a need to change the curriculum?
Because the previous curriculum was about 20 years old. It was a very traditional curriculum with, you know, you do 2 years of physiology, anatomy, et cetera, et cetera. And then you do the clinical training, which, you know, by the time they get to the clinical years, they've forgotten what they learned. So this one integrates all that on, you know, a system basis. It's much, pretty much what the modern medical schools are doing.
I mean, because one of the least transforming industries is probably medical industry because it's as conservative as it goes.
Yeah.
I mean, to actually, you know, be in the front line and then taking UM into the kind of new era because medicine is changing all the time and how the students learn should change as well.
Yeah,
and I really think we congratulate you for that.
And who's actually learning, isn't it?
Exactly.
That's changing as well. Do you think everybody who aspires to be a doctor will have it?
No. I mean, some people may have the intellect, but may not have the soft side to it, you know, because using a well-known cliche, there's an art and a science to being a doctor. And so, and we will have to instill both when we train them.
Fantastic. Yeah. An example? George Lee.
Of course.
The art and the science. Yes.
The art of bullshitting with style.
And I think the other thing that I'm very proud of course, this came with... because of the injection of research funds into UM through the High Impact Research Grant from the Ministry of Higher Education, that we became a publishing machine. You know, from publishing around something like 200 papers in 2000 and you know, before 2010, in the last 2 years, we've published more than 800 papers. Mm-hmm. And when you consider that we have a very big clinical responsibility with PPUM seeing more than 1 million patients a year, I think we've done very, very well. And 50% of our publications in top tier one journals, as they're described. So,
so a good thing overall.
A very good thing.
Okay. I mean, clearly you are a very, very busy person, you know, spearheading all these transformation in UM as a dean, and you're not really letting go of your other hat, really, isn't it?
Not at all.
That's all right, because, you know, you're still appearing in kind of international arena and then, you know, trying to change this whole landscape of HIV and, you know, diagnosis, treatment, and all sorts of things, both in Malaysia and internationally.
Yeah. Just so before we
how
move
do you
to,
do it?
Just, one sec, just before you move on to that, I mean, so you're playing, you know, you play these two hats, right? How do you manage it all?
Exactly.
Because I'm not alone, you know. At the faculty, I've got four fabulous deputy deans. And I should say three out of four are women.
Fantastic.
That's how I do it.
Multitasking.
We are going to be ruling the world.
Absolutely. Oh, right, well,
you are
already.
Yeah. You're definitely ruling the station.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And in the HIV world, I've got, you know, great colleagues in on the clinical side who look after, you know, the wards and the outpatients. Sadly, I hardly do much clinical work now. And the research, yeah, I've got a good team at CHURIA, the Centre for Research in AIDS at UM. And then, of course, Malaysian AIDS Foundation, super, super team. And, of course, a super team at home, the husband and the wife who provides all
always,
the support.
Always.
Couldn't do without.
It's an ecosystem, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's come to HIV/AIDS. How has Malaysia done, Prof. Adiba, in terms of, you know, over the years you've been involved in this field? I know we have done very well to a large extent, but I know it's still not enough. Mm. You just want to go through how we've done over
our
the years?
Our report cards.
Our report cards. So we've come a long way from, you know, in the early 2000s, recording something like 4,000 to 6,000 new infections annually, to now, I think we're down to, it's still high. I think we're down to about 1,000 or so annually. So it's been a remarkable change, and that, you know, largely because of the introduction of the harm reduction program, the needle exchange, and the methadone program, and also the early introduction of maternal screening for pregnant women and providing them with treatment so that we don't have children born with HIV. Babies born with HIV.
And we're doing very well in that area, aren't
we? Are doing extremely well in the area. Sorry, we're recording 3,000 new infections, not 1,000. We want to get to less than 1,000. So yes, we have come a long way, but we've still got a long way to go, because really the international goal is to get zero HIV transmission. Mm. And with the advance in HIV medicine, it's possible. There are countries like Swaziland, of all countries, like Botswana, that and more close to us, Cambodia, that have attained these sort of global goals of 95% being diagnosed, 95% receiving treatment, and 95% have undetectable viral levels. So,
what have they done that we aren't doing?
Yeah, I think in the case of some of these countries, they've had large international support in the way of money, but also in technical assistance. With Cambodia, it was pretty impressive that they had, you know, considering how poor they are, but they have very committed people who work together and, you know, provided scale-up of treatment in very innovative ways. Yeah.
Do you see an increase in the number of HIV cases in a particular group in Malaysia. And the reason I ask you this is because in the UK, they're now finding that there seems to be a rise of almost a third of HIV cases amongst those over the age of 50. Mm-hmm. That may not be a problem here in Malaysia, but do you see groups like that, you know, sort of emerging?
So the concern for us is the rise in sexual transmission as opposed to amongst injecting drug users. A big rise in sexual transmission amongst men who have sex with men, and also, you know, amongst heterosexual. I don't think we've seen such a stark increase in the older group, but that's not to say that we don't see, we do, but mm-hmm. comparatively, you know, percentage-wise. The big concerns are amongst men who have sex with men and heterosexuals, yeah.
Okay.
I quite like to get back to the absolute basic, right? You know, I mean, obviously you highlighted that we've come a long way since 1980s. There are two aspects that I quite like to highlight. You know, in the 80s, it's portrayed that HIV is lethal, and then it kills people, and, you know, it is a death sentence. And then we're talking about 30 years down the line. So can you just highlight a little bit about how lethal is HIV in the 2017? And then, you know, should people be fearful of it? And is it death sentence? And what sort of lifestyle changes? Because we keep dwelling into safe sex, you know, no needles and that sort of things, but we still can't get rid of that taboo. Mm-hmm. So I quite like your opinion about what has changed and what needs to change in 2017.
Yeah, so you know, in terms of medical miracles, I think the advent of what we call highly active antiretroviral therapy has been one of those. You know, I lived through the days, or I trained through the days when there was no treatment and people were literally dying. And George will probably remember mm-hmm. this too. Yeah. You know, upon not long after diagnosis kind of thing. And now, you know, treatment can really, really allow someone to live a normal life, a normal lifespan. And if you get that virus down to what we call undetectable, you will not transmit the infection to your sexual partners, to your injecting partners, or to your baby. So that's why we must get as many people as possible know their HIV status mm-hmm. and then get them onto treatment ASAP mm-hmm. so that it benefits them, their health, as well as prevents that onward transmission.
So essentially that's the kind of breakthrough mm-hmm. that we have achieved, that, you know, we have medication to suppress it to undetectable level, it's not transmissible. At what price? Not in terms of financial cost, like, you know, in terms of, do they need to be on this medication for life, and what sort of like complication do they face?
So sadly, not sadly, but yes, unfortunately now you do need to be on treatment for life until we find either a therapeutic vaccine or a drug that you can give, you know, once a month. But for now, yes, they have to take their medication every day because you can't get rid of the virus completely. Although you have what's called undetectable levels, but there remains latent viruses that as soon as you stop taking the the treatment, it will pop up.
Yeah, so it's sort of like the holy grail of HIV research, actually.
Yeah, so getting rid of essentially that. You're just suppressing.
Correct. Yeah, okay. I mean, the other thing, which obviously in the medical viewpoint, we have that. But in the 80s, we all had that fear that, you know, if the mosquito bite and then it come and bite you, kissing, toilet mm-hmm. seats, spoon sharing, clothes sharing and that sort of thing, right? How far are we down the line of that sort of like fear mongering? That's how people might inject you with, you know, used needles and then you might get it. Yeah, you know, obviously it still strikes fear into a lot of people.
Yeah, it's still there, no doubt. It's still there. But I think on the whole, there is better awareness and less stigma, not zero, but less stigma.
Can you clarify exactly how easy is HIV transmissible? Like, you know, can you clarify about like kissing and, you know, spoon sharing and that sort of thing?
No, you don't get it from those actions. No, you don't, because you do need a reasonable amount of virus in bodily fluids, whether it's blood or am I allowed to say semen?
Mm. Yes, you are.
I just said it.
Call a spade a spade.
Yeah, that's right.
What I found quite disturbing about the report card is 90% of people living with HIV in Malaysia know they have contracted the virus. And obviously, not all of them are coming forward.
Yeah. So that's the sad bit. You know, it's what partly what we call internal stigma, you know, because if you're a gay man or you're a drug user, even if you're not, but, you know, because of this thing that HIV has been associated with, people are afraid to come forward in case they lose their jobs. The family might ostracize them. Yes, it still does happen. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It does happen. And there is reason for them to fear.
Of course.
Mm. Such as?
Yeah, people have, you know, been, you know, lose their jobs and things like that.
Can you clarify? Let's say if somebody, a patient who come to see me and then just routine blood test noted to be HIV positive, exactly what will, as a doctor, I have to go through in reporting and this, and what will happen to this individual and then when they do that? Because this is what they fear of, right? As soon as they get the diagnosis, will that mean that, you know, there will be police coming to investigate them and then put them away and that sort of thing?
So question is, do we have laws in place? We'll come back and discuss that. When somebody is diagnosed with HIV, what happens after? If you have a question for Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We're discussing World AIDS Day on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivisodi. In our Health and Living segment today, Professor Dr. George Lee. Really? I've forgotten. I never call you that. It was just so bizarre, actually, George.
That's right. Yeah,
and Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Medical Faculty in University of Malaya and Chairman of the Malaysian AIDS Foundation. We are discussing HIV/AIDS in view of World AIDS Day on the 1st of December. Of course, we've missed it, but we were talking about stigma and discrimination just now. And George, you asked about what if somebody comes to you.
Newly diagnosed.
Yes, and then are there laws to protect these people?
Yeah. So, first of all, in answer to George's question, what happens? So, yes, by the Infectious Disease Act, we are to...
Obliged
to notify the Ministry of Health of the infection. And in the past... you know, when people were less aware and less well trained, you do hear of pegawai kesihatan come knocking on your doors and saying siapa ni yang nama macam ni ada HIV kind of thing. But I think you hear less of those things. They're much more sensitive in how they handle that information, and so yeah, things have improved a great deal.
Okay. Do we need laws in place?
I think we need laws in place to protect people from being sacked from work. So there's something that we're working with the Ministry of Human Resource, the Malaysian Business Consortium for HIV out of, you know, an outfit out of MAC. We're working with DOSH and other partners to try and get... HIV workplace policies and laws in place so that companies don't ask for mandatory HIV testing in the first place or dismiss people who are HIV positive.
So at the moment, for a company to dismiss somebody who's HIV positive, it's not illegal.
There's no laws to protect. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Hence the need for laws. Yeah. Okay, we have Robert Tan on the line. Robert, you have a question?
Afternoon, Robert.
Hello, good afternoon, Dr. George and Dr. Adiba.
Hello.
Now, formerly when an HIV patient dies, they soak the body in a formalin, is it?
Yeah.
Do they still do it now?
No, they don't.
Great question.
They don't do it. Okay.
Right. Okay. So, Robert obviously is, you know, heard about this. Is that true?
Yeah. In the past, you know, you hear of bodies, you know, being poured on bodies and around the graveyard, and I think this was instrumental in increasing the fear and the stigma.
In
particularly in rural areas, and you immediately identify them as, you know, someone who's died of HIV/AIDS.
And also the family.
And the family. Yeah. So it was a major, major problem.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what we should do is to, you know, what in medicine you should consider everyone as potentially having an infectious disease, and everybody should be treated the same, and you don't need to pour chlorine on their bodies.
Yeah. Everyone is HIV positive until proven otherwise many ways, because, everybody had similar kind of like a risk of exposure, really. Yeah.
Professor, can you just go through again with me? You said that now injecting drug users, the number of the transmissions have dropped, but it's now higher in sexual transmission amongst both heterosexual as well as men having sex with men.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Just to clarify that. Political will and investment. Do you think we have enough of that to push this HIV/AIDS agenda forward?
I think, the fact that we've managed to expand on the needle exchange and the methadone program, to a certain extent we do, but we're still shying on talking about sex and what we need to do and around that. It seems to be harder to talk about sex than sexual transmission.
Safe sex. Yeah. How do we do that? To ensure every child in school learns that they need to protect themselves.
Yeah, I think we've been trying to do this
for the
decades.
Last 30 years, right?
Yeah.
But it's still,
I think we if we look at it kind of medically as well as
socially,
you just have to, and it's in the same way that you advocate for drug users, it's a public health issue and that, our job is to prevent new transmission. And so, whether someone is a gay man or that it's against religion or that's between him and God. Our job, my job, George's job is not to judge or to, worry whether whether he's gay or not, but it is to give them the knowledge and the means to prevent themselves from getting infected.
What do you think Swaziland and Cambodia have done better than us?
They have a slightly different epidemic. In Cambodia, it was mostly a sexual transmission, heterosexual sex work kind of epidemic. And I guess the religious conservatism there is probably not like us. In Swaziland, it is a completely different epidemic again. But yeah, it's not that these places don't have, all the taboos either.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need to approach it from a public health aspect. And that means, getting more people aware and getting them tested. Whether you're gay or whether you're straight, it's irrelevant because your risk is the same, And so we need to draw people to come forward to be tested and then get treated.
Adiba, I'm going to dwell a little bit about the question about when somebody is diagnosed. You said pegawai will go there to approach there, presumably counselling and all sorts of things. And then what will happen to this individual? I mean, can healthcare profession kind of like impose or force antiviral treatment to them? What happened if they have a choice not to accept this? What happens?
What sort of support do they get?
As medical doctors, we can't impose treatment on anyone
if they don't
want to.
Well, indeed, because sometimes you make the diagnosis and then patients choose not to even seek help at all. So how do we... And as a law, suddenly they're registered being HIV positive. And then is that the end of the issues from that point onward?
So I think that is why, when someone goes to have themselves tested, that counselling that you talk about is about giving information to the patient, like what will happen now, first of all, what I tend to do is to allay the fears. Look, you're not going to die tomorrow kind of thing.
Because in the past, we have people committed suicide as soon as they find out.
Correct. you know, what treatment is available, how often should you be followed up and all that. So that, I think that's part of the early kind of engagement you try and have with them. You know, I still recall this man when I was in clinic. This was years ago, you know, and I told him that he was HIV positive, and then he sort of said, you know, that means I'm going to die tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, why would you die tomorrow? He said, you know, he already knew actually that he was positive and didn't want to come in because of that. He said he'd already bought all his funeral gear and all that, and was just shocked when I told him, like, you're going to live. Yeah. He said, I said, you could live another 30 years. He said, I don't want that much time. He said, I'll be 80 by then.
That's interesting. Yeah.
What about communities? Are there certain communities, those in, you know, who are socioeconomically challenged, for an example, mm-hmm. who sort of, there is a strong link between HIV and poverty. Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. still the case in Malaysia?
Yes, there is. And I think particularly with people who inject drugs, you know, that link with poverty is very, very strong, and that gives them the vulnerability to HIV. But even for the non-injecting drugs, because poverty means you have less access to information, and so, yeah. And even practical things like coming forward, going to clinics and things like that can be a hindrance, yeah. you know, can be a challenge.
How do we in Malaysia get these messages through?
You know, I think social media is, everyone seems to have a Facebook account in Malaysia, so we need to do better. I must admit, we need to do better in giving out that information through more modern, inexpensive ways. And in many ways, I think to skirt around the issues of, you know, how do we reach out to gay men and all that, the answer is through technology. Yeah. And there are many research examples of people reaching out through Grindr, through you know, Facebook, social media, and such.
I mean,
like,
if you think about it, just about everybody I know has a mobile mm-hmm. phone, mm-hmm. Regardless of whether you're in a socioeconomically challenged or not. Yeah. We boast broadband penetration rate and all of that. So you're right, tech can actually play a huge role.
Well, I have an idea. I think one of the, I mean, we keep talking about awareness, and awareness. I genuinely think that the society is aware. Mm. However, there are certain things that I feel that might change becoming the game changers. I think one of the reasons why Swaziland and Cambodia is probably doing well is accessibility to the antiviral. Do you think there are two groups of people the accessibility will be crucial in terms of bringing this down? Number one is the cost of the price. If it's completely almost free, and then
it is free. It's been free for ages.
Yeah, but many people don't know that. Yeah. And then that's number one. And number two is for people who are exposed and then actually take the prophylaxis, mm-hmm. availability of prophylaxis, which in Malaysia is not really that easily accessible.
George, for a urologist, I'm impressed.
Yeah, that's right.
You're talking about treatment for prevention and PrEP.
Correct.
So
let's talk about the prophylaxis. What is it?
Okay, so PrEP stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it's a drug called Truvada that you take, either take on an everyday basis or take on demand. If you think you're going to be at, if this is for an HIV, obviously for an HIV uninfected person, you think you're going to be at risk, you take this pre-exposure prophylaxis, and it has been shown in a number of seminal studies to be very effective in preventing someone from getting infected. Yeah. It's like the oral contraceptive pill.
That's right. Yeah,
so the morning after pill.
But it's not that easily accessible in Malaysian setting, isn't that true?
So actually, Malaysia has, at least the Ministry of Health has said, you know, PrEP is something that we should do, but it's not, not easily accessible. People have to go to clinics, and obviously you need a prescription. Mm. But, you know, and I think there is, there is you do need some regulations, because you can't just be taking these drugs and not have yourself regularly tested.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So then it needs to be a program. It shouldn't just be out there.
Yeah. So and based on that, right, I think we might see consequences, because if, let's say, Cambodia and Swaziland is doing so well currently, so many people are on the medication, the antiviral, would there be a day when we begin to see resistance because it's so widely accessible, just like antibiotics? Are we seeing that apocalypse happening soon?
Yes, we are. There's concerns about increasing resistance.
There is.
But probably not to the same extent of, say, you know, some of the antibiotics, or anti-TB is a big concern. So that's why one has to, we in the medical sciences have to make treatments simpler and affordable and accessible, because there's some of the reasons why people fall off treatment. You know, they're doing so well and then they get tired of it, or they develop complications, or, you know, they live too far away and can't get to treatment sites and stuff like that. So many reasons why people stop taking treatment at the individual level or systems level. So those things need to be addressed.
I can imagine it. You know, this is for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. You need to be compliant.
Mm-hmm. And disciplined, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Speaking about PrEP, Scotland is the first jurisdiction in the UK to approve the use of this treatment. Mm-hmm. Why Scotland? I mean, why did they decide?
Actually, the Scottish Health Department is very progressive. They're also one of the first governments to expand hepatitis C treatment, including hepatitis C treatment in prison. I think they're just on the ball.
Okay.
Yeah, very progressive.
Terribly progressive. Yeah. Okay, we'll come back and continue this discussion. If you have a question, give us a call. We're discussing HIV/AIDS with Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman and Dr. George Lee. Give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sivasodi in our Health and Living segment, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. And joining us today as well is Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman. She is the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya and Chairman of the Malaysian AIDS Foundation. Today, the topic is in line with World AIDS Day, and the theme was actually, well, let's end it. We wish it were that simple, but it's a good way to actually start moving forward. Michael, you have a question for us.
Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering why in the past that the drug users are more prone to getting AIDS. Is there a correlation of their addictions to their sexual lifestyle?
Mm-hmm. Great question.
Thank you very much, Michael.
So actually, Michael, the most common reason drug users are at more risk is because of sharing, because they share needles. So if you have one person who is carrying the virus and you share that needle that you're using to inject drugs with your three or four other injecting partners, that carries a very, very high risk of being infected, because you've got a syringe full of blood, which has millions of viruses in it.
So Michael has no, there's no concerns about drug users are more promiscuous and then have higher risk of HIV?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Thank you.
Jade, you have a question?
Hi, Jade.
Hi, my name is Jade, and my question is, there have been recent incidences where people have lost jobs, opportunities, when their employers find out that they are HIV positive.
Mm.
So my question is, what can they do?
Great question.
Thank you, Jade.
Yeah, so we were talking about this earlier, Jade, in terms of, one of the things MEC and MAF is advocating for is laws to protect people from losing their jobs if they're found to be HIV positive. They can challenge and sue their employers, I think, but a lot of people don't want to take that step because then it exposes them, etc., etc. So not many people are willing to come forward.
Film Philadelphia,
yeah,
right? Okay,
correct.
What is it? Do a Philadelphia. That's like, right, okay.
Okay, coming back to Malaysia, not we would like more people to access treatment, but they're not. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah, so treatment has been available in government hospitals for free since, oh, I don't know, 2001, like, you know, for a long, long time. But yeah, despite it being free of charge, you know, by right, we should have 80, 90% of people who are on treatment, who needs treatment, are on treatment. But sadly, we've only got something like 40%. And I think several reasons. One is the patients themselves are afraid to come forward, even if they know that they're HIV positive. They're afraid for all those things that, that you know, they'll get stigmatized, they'll get discriminated against, etc. Then, you know, not all healthcare workers are nice and friendly and will have the, you know, look after them with open arms. So there's also that, that concern that they'll be discriminated. And you know, we've done studies on this as well, looking at medical students as well as doctors who discriminate. And then there's access, not because... Well, things have improved. In the past, they would have to go to big hospitals to get treatment. But now, treatment is available even in clinic kesehatans around the country.
Okay. I mean, clearly, this is a challenge that you face, right? Okay, you know, you can't seem to get that mark, you know, to reach that 95%. And I was like, how do you think we can do better in order to overcome that challenge?
The other big group that probably is not accessing treatment as they should are the injecting drug users, because they lead chaotic lives. And so doctors are afraid to start them on treatment in case they stop. And then, you know, they develop resistance, the drugs develop resistance, the virus develops resistance. The key to that would be to stabilize them on methadone and buprenorphine, or you know,
and then start the antiretroviral.
So stabilize.
Okay. Is there any hopes of a cure in sight at all?
So there is a there are big research programs looking for HIV cure, and I think you know, getting to what we call functional cure, which means finding treatment that where you don't have to take treatment every day. You know, we're probably not far from that. But to completely get rid of the virus, cure as we know it, it's going to be a long while yet. But, you know, I'm not sure that
Is that necessary?
Yeah,
is that what you're
saying? It's not necessary, you know, because like diabetes, for instance, people do well on treatment. Right.
And technically, it's just like a chronic disease.
A chronic
right?
disease, yeah. And we do have very, very good treatment as it is. And the drugs are getting less and less toxic and easier. You know, in the early days of HIV, when protease inhibitors became available, you had to take something like 8 pills 3 times a day. And that's for only one. You have to take 3 different types. So people ended up taking 30, 40 pills a day. No one can do that, you know, forever. But now you can just take 1 pill in the morning and 1 pill at night.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I would be happy if there was a cure.
Of course.
You know, just
I must
know
say,
that
I think
a cure.
The cure will come before a vaccine.
Yeah. Well, there are probably listeners out there who think that there's a conspiracy because they don't want cure, they want to sell drugs.
Yes, I was just about to say that, you know.
I can read this woman's mind now. I was like, is there a conspiracy?
Yeah. Let them be on medication for the rest of their lives.
Right, okay.
You know?
I mean, obviously, you know, we're running out of time, but a few things I want to ask you is like, you know, next year is the 20th day of World AIDS Day. 20th year. It's like a 20th celebration. You know, what is the theme? Earlier on, we talked about the theme that let's cure it, let's get rid of it altogether. And what exactly have we done in Malaysia, and in what sort of activities are you involved in so far?
Yeah, so I think, you know, making people know that there is good treatment available, and that people, you know, that you must come forward and know your HIV status and then go on to treatment. That is the kind of focus that we want to maintain. So the 95, 95, 95. mantra. So 95% of people must be diagnosed. So 95% of people should go on treatment, and 95% should have undetectable viral
levels. And this year you were in Tanah Merah, our home state, right?
Yes, yes.
At so this stage, I feel left out.
You feel left out. This is when you say, did you just go there for the nasi daging?
No, I didn't.
Kupu Leko. Kupu Leko is not quite. It's neighbouring.
That's neighbouring. Oh,
that's right.
Nasi tumpeh.
Okay.
Is that nasi tumpang?
Yeah.
I love that stuff.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. You should go to Tanah Merah more.
Absolutely.
Nasi Rabu,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, what exactly, what was the campaign?
So we were actually supporting a Ministry of Health event. And Ministry of Health, rightly so, I think, felt that it was important that we go out into more rural areas. And in this case, in Felda Kemahang, where, you know, there are concerns about injecting drug use there, and to bring awareness, but also to officiate, YB Minister of Health, Datuk Sri Subramaniam, officiated a cabin for needle exchange that's run by our NGO, Sahabat, who's doing amazing work there.
Wow.
Which sits right next to Klinik Kesihatan Kemahang. You know, when you think of where we were, to have needle exchange center right next to Klinik Kesihatan, we've come a long way.
Yeah,
I was very proud of that
because
moment.
I'm sure you should be very proud of it. It's because majority of people would think that, you know, drug abuse and things is an urban problem. But, you know, clearly, you know, for ministry to, in collaboration with you guys, to set it up in, like, the heart of Kelantan, Tanah Merah.
We even had a demonstration of how to put on condoms nobody bet an eyelid.
Yeah, that's right.
Just do it, man.
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm so proud. I can actually see light at the end of the tunnel.
If we can accept that in Kelantan, we can accept that anywhere in Malaysia, right? Yeah.
Okay. Your message, Prof. Adiba?
Well, my message that, you know, we need to go all out to try and end AIDS. It cannot just be a slogan, but it needs everyone to, you know, put in all our efforts to make it happen.
George?
Well, I just want to know how you do all these. I just think that you're doing fantastic work, both in academic research and then clearly for this social responsibility to push the AIDS agenda.
And she's empowering all the women.
Exactly.
In decision-making positions, George.
Indeed. Mm. No, thank you for all that effort.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was Professor Dr. Adiba Kamaruzaman, Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, and Chairman of the Malaysian AIDS Foundation, together with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.